Welcome to The Advertising Show, America's only radio program focusing on advertising, media, marketing, product development, branding, new media, sales and customer relations. Stay with us for entertaining marketing discussion and our special guest interview. Now, here are your hosts, Ray Schillins and Brad Forsythe.
It is The Advertising Show with Ray Schillins and Brad Forsythe, being brought to you by Advertising Age Magazine. You can visit Ad Age online at adage.com. How convenient. This is a Big Radio Midgets production here on the SSI Radio Network as we welcome a special guest today. His name is, we got it right here, Chuck Sable. This is actually Charles Sable. We're going to call him Chuck, okay?
More casual.
That's a good idea. Sure. Curator at the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising Design. We'll be talking with Chuck out of Milwaukee today, and we'll be joining him, and he'll be joining us here in about 15 minutes from now.
Yeah.
On the way, the wacky world of marketing, with Bruce Abbott, that's coming up this half hour. We've got Jeffrey Gittimer, the sales guru. I don't call him a sales guru, maybe a sales and relationship guru. How does that sound?
Well, until he starts paying us, let's go with guru.
Just call him Jeffrey.
No. Hey, you know, you're a big fan of reality TV, aren't you?
To a certain extent.
Yeah.
Which means no.
If it has to do with home improvement.
I was at the gym talking about reality TV, and right. They have the screens up there that you can watch TV.
Right.
And this last show had celebrities.
Show? Which show?
Fear Factor.
Oh.
Had celebrities laying in a plastic case, a plexiglass case.
With bugs thrown on them.
Well, no, it wasn't just bugs. It was earthworms, night crawlers thrown on there below the knees. It was hissing cockroaches, Madagascar cockroaches on their heads.
Reminds me of a fraternity initiation I once
went
through.
And if that's not enough, how about a batch of snakes
really?
On your middle? But you had to pick out the white snakes and put them in a thing. And that's sick.
You
that's
know,
absolutely
snake,
sick.
Snakes in the middle can be a little risque.
Yes, they can.
Male or female.
Right.
Hey, you know, and the reason I was asking about reality TV, earlier in the week I was watching this program because my wife makes me watch this.
Sure she does.
It's called Will You Marry My Dad?
Just like you make her watch Sue Johansson, right?
Sunday Night Sex Show.
Exactly.
That's right.
Go ahead.
On E, not on E, it's on Oxygen,
right.
Yeah. What we're lacking right now in this little room. Anyway, the NBC's Will You Marry My Dad, I have, if you're familiar with this, the guy that's being featured on this,
mm-hmm.
he looks like a cancer survivor because he's bald.
Okay.
Looks like he just went through chemo. A lot of women say he's handsome. I don't know.
Oh.
But anyway, here's the point. I'm looking at this. I'm watching this family, and they're like in week number 3 or 4, and they finally pick who the dad, the children, the family, pick who dad is going to marry.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm watching this, and I'm thinking, you know, 4 or 5 weeks into this deal, this guy's really on bent knee. He's proposing to this lady that his children picked for him.
Okay.
And I'm thinking they need to retitle this.
What?
What is your family willing to do to be on TV as opposed to Will You Marry My Dad? I mean, my goodness. Marriage, what's this going to tell the youth of today, that marriage is something that's, you know, just kind of whatever and get on reality TV and if your kids—
I think youth already has that fixation with a lack of real commitment to something.
Well—
Not necessarily all, but I think that's more of an attitude than it used to be.
And just to verify that, how long have you been married?
Since 1971.
Can't do the math.
A long time.
Yeah, it is a long time.
30-plus years.
Yeah. I've been married quite a while myself, especially if you combine both marriages. It's a long time.
That's fine.
Yeah. Anyway, I thought that was weird. You know, today's kids are going to look at that and say, well, you know, getting married is something so casual that even your family can decide for you.
Yeah, I don't like that at all.
It's crazy.
That's strange.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Arnold. All you got to say
communications?
Is Arnold. Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, Arnold, yeah.
Arnold Schwarzenegger Communications.
Arnold, you mean.
Yes. Let's talk about him in just a minute. Right now, it's Jeffrey Gittimer on The Advertising Show.
Quick takes on sales and customer relations with Jeffrey Gittimer, nationally syndicated columnist in the network of City Business Journals and other great publications worldwide. If you're offended by common sense commentary, don't you dare listen. Now, here's Jeffrey.
I've just been handed a news alert. Salespeople are all moaning that sales are slow or less than they were, and their competition is fiercer because they're hurting too, and price is more of an issue. Let me give you a few rules and guidelines, a sort of an understanding of this process, especially as it relates to new prospects. First of all, There are levels of prospects. Cold call is a low level. Direct mail is a low level. Networking is a mid-level. But referral and unsolicited referral are the highest levels. You want to go from low level to high level? In other words, from cold calls to referrals? Here are the guidelines. It takes time. It takes smarts. It takes always being ready. It takes hard work, and it takes being your best. Your biggest job as a professional salesperson is to convert your prospecting prospect to a level of referrals and unsolicited referrals. This will help you in any economy. Before you blame your leads or your territory or your category, you may want to take a close look at yourself, the last bastion of sales blame. Bad leads? Bad appointments? Bad economy? No. Bad salesperson. Unprepared salesperson.
Quick takes on sales and customer relations from The Advertising Show, the only radio show in America featuring Jeffrey Gittimer as a regular weekly guest. To learn more about his books, tapes, CDs, and speaking engagements, log on to Gittimer.com, G-I-T-O-M-E-R.com. And tune in next week when we'll hear Jeffrey say,
"This is Jeffrey Gittimer reminding you that if no one responds to your ad, it may be because your ad sucks."
Love the way he presents himself there on The Advertising Show, Jeffrey Gittimer, and we'll regular feature here on the show every week. You hear mm-hmm. him, along with such greats as what do we have coming up here? We got Andy Borowitz, always funny. Mm-hmm. Who Moved My Soap? The CEO's Guide to Surviving in Prison, and of course Fusion 5 with Patrick Meyer, too.
Marketing Insider, and my favorite each hour
is the
Wacky World of Marketing.
Okay,
comes up right after the first segment of the interview. You were talking about Arnold or Arnold.
Yeah, Arnold. I think he's going to win. I'd put my money on Arnold. What do you think?
Well, I'm either going with Arnold or I'm going with who's the short guy? That's
Gary Coleman.
Yeah, Gary Coleman.
Yeah, sure.
Name recognition.
No.
I mean, that's what it's going to all be about. It's been argued that once Arnold gets past the name recognition and he gets into some debates and the press starts asking him some questions of significance, he's going to lose it.
You think so?
Well, that's what they say.
That's
I don't know.
What do you think?
I don't know how politically strong he is. You know, he's in that Kennedy family. Or that Kennedy
true.
Shriver family
yeah,
or
true.
Whatever. So anyway, did he learn something along the way in being in that family? I guess time will tell. We're about to see that, I'm sure.
I think what's going to happen is he's going to get elected. Absolutely.
It wouldn't surprise me.
He's going to – and you know what's happened now? The California advertising, the whole thing's upside down because what they're doing is they're bumping paid commercial spots to run these political spots.
Well, they
for
have
the big,
to,
they do. They have
yeah,
to.
Right.
And what it's going to do, it's going to take away from what they're saying. It's taking away from the opportunity to advertise the back-to-school stuff that it is
so there,
dated.
There, there
so
goes your economy.
Yeah, the revenue's gone. I mean,
that's,
you can't make up a get-back-to-school sale 12 weeks into school.
I hadn't heard that. That's interesting.
So.
You know, I've heard Arnold Schwarzenegger refer to the position of governor.
Mm-hmm.
He's called it president a few times. I want to be president of California.
Well, there's Ron Reagan, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Keep that in mind. On the way, we're going to talk to Chuck Sable, curator at the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design, live from Milwaukee. Stick around.
You're listening to The Advertising Show with Ray Schillins and Brad Forsythe.
Snap, what a happy sound. Snap is the happiest sound I've found. You may clap, rap, clap, clap, but snap makes the world go round. Snap, crackle, Rice Krispies. I say it's crackle.
It's on The Advertising Show. It's Ray Schillins and Brad Forsythe back with you and talking to Chuck Sable, curator at the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design. I think Chuck liked that spot.
I heard
he
it.
Did.
Yeah, but before we do that, before we bring you on here, Chuck, I want to tell the folks a little bit about you and about the museum. Let's start out with the museum. The William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design is an interactive educational center focusing on advertising and design and their impact on our culture, honoring and lending recognition to past achievements, possibly even that spot within the scope of advertising and design. fostering public awareness of the influential role of advertising and design in society, and serving as an educational resource for advertising and design students and professionals and the community at large. It's in Milwaukee. Now, why is it called William F. Eisner? Well, William F. Eisner opened an advertising agency in Milwaukee at the age of 33, graduate of both the Layton School of Art, the predecessor to the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, and Marquette University. He was both an innovator and an entrepreneur. He led the National Federation of Advertising Agencies as president, shared his insights as mentor and teacher for students at Marquette. Elaine Eisner began to formulate the idea of the museum after her husband's death in 1990, and about a year later, Elaine approached Terrence Kaufman, president of MIAD, with her dream. 10 years later, the dream is now a reality, and that brings us to today, here on the Advertising Show with Chuck Sable, who's the curator of the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design. That's a long intro, but it's necessary to set this whole thing up. So.
Well, and you know, I get to mark through question number 7, which has to do with tell me about who William F. Eisner is and why he was named after the museum. So maybe, thank you, Ray.
Maybe we need to go back to asking questions like, Chuck, boxers or briefs? You know, I don't know.
Actually, next time when we have a guest, I'll just say, let me interview Ray for a few minutes here.
Yeah, right.
Hey,
but wait, I have more.
Yeah.
Not.
Chuck, you know, you mentioned curator. I think a lot of people might be curious, what the hell does a curator do for a museum? Talk a little bit about that.
Okay. There are lots of different kinds of curators out there, as many different kinds of curators as there are museums. In the classical sense, what a curator does is two jobs, essentially. One is cares for the collection. That's where the title comes from. From Latin, and the other is to produce exhibits, which is what I do.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, no. We're going to talk about some of the exhibits that you've had, both past and present. But for those that may be familiar with the Milwaukee area, describe exactly where the William F. Eisner Museum happens to be located.
We're located in downtown Milwaukee in a renovated area, sort of a Soho of Milwaukee, called the Third Ward. And our address is 208 North Water Street, mm-hmm. on the corner of Water and Chicago in downtown Milwaukee, as I said, in an old 105-7 years old loft building.
Mm-hmm. So if you're getting in a taxi right now and you're needing an address, there you go. Just tell them to take you to the museum. Have you, I guess, membership for our listeners today and going through the museum, Ray?
Mm-hmm.
Free.
Really?
Free for everyone listening to go to the museum today, not in Milwaukee, but here on the Advertising Show.
Oh,
but,
I see. Okay.
But for those that may or not be familiar with it, what are your membership fees for the museum, Chuck?
Our membership fee for annual membership is $40, and we have sliding scales going up above that. And I'm not familiar exactly with what they are at this point, but they go up from there.
So you'd probably charge us a lot to get in there because you probably would be afraid to have us in the museum. Is that right, Chuck?
No, you can come anytime.
Can we? Okay.
Well, you know,
don't touch that, Brad.
We were, yeah, we were invited to the Museum of Broadcasting by a former guest, and
you misunderstood that invitation. He just wanted us to be there as a museum artifact.
Well, that's true.
Just sitting around a table.
His name is Bruce DeMont, as I recall, and he invited us to the. It happens to be located in Chicago, and invited both Ray and I to broadcast our show from the Museum of Broadcast. I know you have a radio facility there in terms of. Opportunity to listen, and before we jump into that, I want to save that for a little bit later because
okay.
I want to drill down on the description. Let me ask you kind of a philosophical question, Chuck. You know, I think museums are often thought of as more formal and less sedate or more sedate places when it comes to a museum in general. But yet, advertising, I think a lot of people believe, is more exciting and cutting edge. How do you strike a balance between a museum that showcases the exciting world of advertising and design?
Sure. What we try to do here is choose topics that no one else touches. In the standard museum world, in the scholarly museum world, our topics range from things like character trademarks to record album covers, things like that, real popular topics that the public would like. We don't sit here and look at every last advertising collectible that you can think of and get into them in such a way that it appeals to one or two collectors out there. Rather, the goal of our exhibition schedule is to put together shows that someone might not have wanted to do before, like a history of feminist advertising since the 60s, but also that looks at it from a popular point of view, so the general public would want to come in.
So I think you guys in the museum business, some reference about you're not collection driven or what?
Right.
Yeah, the so let's talk about that. You mentioned trademarks. That's something that both Ray and I have an interest in. How was your exhibit on trademarks? How did you display that? What did it involve, et cetera?
Sure. What we did in that particular show was use cutouts, basically. We didn't use a lot of archival stuff. Since we're not archivally driven, I used large-scale cutouts of the Jolly Green Giant, the Chicken of the Sea, Mermaid. Oh, gosh, I can't remember all the different ones. We had lots of doughboys around. And what I did was, in the arrangement of the show, was to use tear sheets as well, talking about the evolution of some of these figures, like Tony the Tiger, like the Rice Krispies guys who you just had on a little while ago, Snap, Crackle, and Pop. Where did they came from? What were their stories? How did they develop? And we also grouped them by type. What were the earliest character trademark? Well, the first character trademark was the Quaker Oats Man way back in the 1880s. So how did they evolve? Then the various, what we call, archetypes. Who were the magic figures, cartoon figures, and what kinds of products are they used on? And, of course, then we talked about the great king of character trademarks, Leo Burnett.
Sure. And you say tear sheets, and the agency business, those are copies of ads that you get from a publication. You mean descriptive information that would go underneath the particular trademark?
Yes. Well, we actually used real ads.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay. Well, good. For our listeners not familiar, they are now. Tear sheets are actual copies of ads that perform in publications as a complete page. You mentioned something that triggered a thought. Yeah, cartoon characters today happen to be very popular as developed as trademarks, but yet that goes back several years, doesn't it, Chuck?
Oh, yeah. Cartoon characters, well, they go back to really the 50s when television comes in, television advertising comes in. Although there are lots of other character trademarks that predate, tons of them that predate that. One of my favorite live-action character trademarks, and that was a specific type within the show, was Johnny Roventini. And some of your older listeners will remember who he was. You guys
know? I don't remember. Do you?
No.
No. Tell us who that is.
Call for Philip Morris.
Ah, okay.
Really? Well,
oh, the guy with the valet suit or whatever you want to call it, the hotel, bell cap, I guess.
I thought the guy was all made famous from being the guy in the commercial.
He was a real bellhop.
Oh, he was
he really.
And
huh.
He was part of an ad campaign or a stunt, basically, that a couple of executives did in New York at a place called the New Yorker Hotel, I think in '34, and it worked. And he got on the radio, and he became famous, and he spent the rest of his life as Johnny on the Spot.
Johnny on the Spot.
You know, you mentioned that characters evolving from television back in the 50s. When I walked in today to do the show this morning, Ray was taking his Flintstone vitamins, so I guess apparently it has had an impact on some people.
Yeah. Flintstone geriatric version, actually.
Well,
exactly. Extra calcium on the advertising show. It's Ray Shillings along with Brad Forsyth. Our special guest today is Chuck Sable, who's the curator at the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design. I wish we could take you there right now. If you're in the Milwaukee area, though, that'd be a good place to go this weekend, possibly, or maybe next weekend.
Well, in the Museum of the Mind, we'll take you there.
Yes, we will.
And free of charge, I might add.
That's a good thing. Advertising show is also streaming live online here at theadvertisingshow.com. Of course, we're here on the SSI Radio Network. Wacky World of Marketing with Bruce Abbott coming up in just a moment. Matter of fact, it's like next, okay? So if you tune off or, you know, do something else,
you're going to miss it.
Don't do that, okay?
No, don't.
We don't like that. Back in just a minute with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth and Chuck Sable on Milwaukee.
It's time for the Wacky World of Marketing.
Wacky World of Marketing.
Here's your host, Bruce Abbott.
Our wacky update heads to the Playboy Mansion, where Hef has plans on animated TV, starring himself and his famed centerfold girls in another move to introduce the Playboy brand to younger generations. Hef will be the mastermind behind a sexy, sophisticated squad of playmates that fight the, quote, enemies of the democracy in Hef's Super Bunnies. Unlike the centerfold girls that have made Playboy a highly successful magazine for men since its launch back in 1953, the Super Bunnies will not bear all in the new show. And that, my friends, is the Wacky World of Marketing.
This program was written and produced by Bruce Abbott, executive producer of The Advertising Show. Join us next time when we uncover the strange, the bizarre, and, unfortunately, the true Wacky World of Marketing.
We'll be right back.
Make informed decisions about your company's advertising strategy. This is The Advertising Show.
Hello, amigo. I'm Chiquita Banana, and I've come to say bananas have to ripen in a certain way, and when they're flecked with brown and have a golden hue, bananas taste the best and are the best for you. You can put them in
a... Back with the Advertising Show with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth, and our special guest today, Chuck Sable. Chuck used to date the Chiquita Banana lady, I think.
Did
he? You know, no, maybe he didn't.
The
maybe
great
didn't.
Part about her is she taught you how to use a banana.
I mean, and that's all
salad,
we gotta say.
In a salad, she teaches it.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
That's interesting.
You get a pretty lady to dance and sing and tell you how to eat a banana.
I understand.
What a concept.
Historically, they were torn between putting directions on bananas on how to use them, but they decided just to go with an ad campaign.
Chuck Sable is the curator of the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design out of Milwaukee, and we're pointing out the fact that if you're in the area, in Milwaukee, then go. If you haven't been, go there. But you can also hit it from where?
Chicago.
Madison.
Fargo.
Oh, yeah. If you're willing to take a ride.
International Falls.
And if you're catching us in the
Marquette.
Canada area from a skip, they say, in the broadcast business, then go south to Milwaukee.
Turn left at the border. Yeah.
Describe for us, if you would, Chuck, our audience who are not familiar with the museum, and I'm sure that's many. We hit the door. We're walking in the door. What do we see, Chuck?
Doorknob.
Is our freebie show, which is called Corporate Identities. Actually, it's the power of advertising, corporate identities. And it gives you a glimpse at some of the major companies' visual identities and how they developed and why they developed. Why do some corporations keep a visual identity? Why do some corporations change it?
Well, wait a minute. Before we go further, if you have the answer to that, Ray and I would love to know, because we keep finding that there is no rhyme or reason that some keep and some bail on their corporate identity.
What I've been able to discern just in my digging around on this thing is, and what we've done is, if a company's identity works, although it doesn't work for one company, I'll mention in a second, they usually try to keep it. If they're selling, if their sales are good, they usually will keep it. That's the best case of that is GE, who's kept their same corporate identity since 1896.
Mm-hmm.
One that had a great corporate identity that just changed it recently was UPS.
Mm-hmm.
The famous Paul Rand, the great designer, corporate identity designed for them about 1961 or 62, and within the last three, 4 months, they've changed it.
Hmm. I didn't notice that. I guess I'm.
Well, they're going with Brown now.
Well, Brown was Paul Rand. That's what he came up with. But they've changed.
Paul Rand.
Oh, they've changed that now.
They're still going with Brown. That was Paul Rand.
Yeah.
But they've changed the visual look, the lettering, the graphic.
Wow. I'm going to have to check that out. You know, another example of someone that changed to the better, I think, since we're talking about delivery services, is FedEx. Everybody started calling it FedEx, even though it was said Federal Express on the trucks, and they decided, well, let's go with that. And since we're talking about corporate identities, several weeks ago, Ray, when we had Jack Trout on the show, he mentions in his book that you should always try to create a name for a company and not go with initials. And I forgot to ask him, you mean like IBM or GM or companies like that? Anyway, have you conducted any research, Chuck, as to who attends your museum? Are they mostly in the local area, or you get national, international folks?
We get a lot of national visitors. Anyone who comes to Milwaukee, and especially in the summertime for festivals, ethnic festivals, and Summerfest, which is the world's largest music festival, come in here. I'd say about half of our attendance is non-local.
Mm-hmm.
The rest is a big chunk are school groups who come in here, and then we get a lot of local people too. The rest are local.
Yeah, in a lot of your literature, your museum literature mentions that advertising, it explores the fact that advertising is part science and part art, and certainly that's something that Ray and I have discussed considerably here on the Advertising Show. Give me your take on the ratio, if you will, of advertising being part science and part art.
I would say personally it's about 50-50.
Well, apparently Chuck's running for governor of California.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great politically correct answer.
I guess it was. You can't go wrong.
No, you really can't.
50-50.
You know, my feeling, Chuck, is that sometimes it is 50-50, but usually it is erring to one side or the other, depending on the particular approach. I've never really been able to figure that out. I think
I go with 60-40, and it takes Seabiscuit in the trifecta.
Yeah. You know, they say heart surgeons, for example, are part science and part art, and I would agree with that. You know, I want somebody nimble that's artistic, but I'm not looking for a nice design on my heart.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, get the science in there, folks.
Right. So, staying with some of this philosophy, I'm curious on your take on this, Chuck, because you're a great person to bounce this off of. Do you think advertising reflects our culture, or does advertising mold and influence our culture?
Oh, my gosh. That's a question I actually get a lot. I tend to think right now, I flip-flop on that question myself a little bit.
That doesn't surprise me.
right now, I'm tending to lead. The way I look at advertising right now is in the way I think of what's gone on in the last few years, especially in the last 20 years, is advertising really is reflective of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
It does not mold the culture. In other words, it takes a couple of beats and then it jumps in.
Right. You know, and I know you're not soliciting, but I'm going to offer anyway. I think in many cases it does reflect our culture, but in some cases it actually can influence and mold. And a good example, I think, I'm going to go back to a spot we play occasionally here on the advertising show, Jordache jeans.
Yeah.
I mean, before Jordache jeans, people weren't really, you know, wearing jeans to the disco. But once that spot broke, which was all about being in a disco and having that logo on the back part of your, your back pocket there?
That's right.
Of course, put a nice-looking woman with the back pocket logo, and what are you looking at?
Jordache jeans.
You got it.
A nice woman.
Yeah.
In just a minute, we'll come back and talk more with Chuck Sable, curator at the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design. Stick around on The Advertising Show.
Ray Schillens and Brad Forsythe are taking your questions at theadvertisingshow.com. You're listening to The Advertising Show on the SSI Radio Network.
Once upon a time there was an engineer. Choo-choo Charlie was his name, we hear. He had an engine and he sure had fun. He used good and plenty candy to make his train run.
Charlie says, love my good and plenty. Charlie says, really
makes
the
bell. Where's a product I haven't had in a long time. Mm-hmm. Not on the Atkins diet, though, you know. Maybe it is. Who knows? There we go. Good and Plenty and The Advertising Show. Got plenty more here with Chuck Sable, who's a curator of the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design, is Ray Schillens and Brad Forsythe.
Yeah, Chuck, I wanted to ask you, how does the Eisner Museum go about presenting exhibits that explore advertising from a cultural context?
When you look at them historically, I'm thinking of a great one. Oh, our VW show is a good one, good example. I mean, it talked about 60s culture, and it looked at the role of advertising, the advertising of the VW, had it played in 60s culture. Then it looked at the changes that happened in the late 60s and early 70s culture that really marked the end of the VW and its advertising and how that really led to other cultural changes, the VW ads themselves. And then it looked at the revival of VW in the 1990s, the fact that VW was about to pull out of the American market.
And did for a while, at least with the Super Beetle, or, you know.
True.
Went away.
Right.
So, how detailed, I'm curious, since you hit upon Volkswagen, Ray and I are very familiar with certainly the Volkswagen, what I consider really the birth of the creative revolution back in the early 60s,
right.
And Doyle Dane Birnbach being the agency that developed that. A great friend of the show, George Lois, who's been a guest on our show, was part of the development of the Think Small campaign for Volkswagen. How detailed do you get when you look at a Volkswagen campaign? Do you name names? Do you talk about Birnbach and his involvement? Do you mention George Lois, et cetera?
Right, we did. We talked about DDB as a company, who they were, why they were interested in doing this, why VW chose them was a big part of the text in that particular section of the show.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get as detailed as talking about George Lois in that part of the show, but rather talked about the cultural component, focused on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I showed a whole slew of print ads and also television.
You know, you're making me want to go there, Ray. Do we have a reservation?
I'm sure that Southwest flies there, so not a problem.
Yeah, and you call that the company plane still, don't you?
Yes, we do. Or I'll fly as there.
You know, Ray and I both had an interest in Groovy Ads, which was an exhibit that opened July 27th, and it was psychedelics from the 60s, and Ray's particular interest is because he did plenty of psychedelics during the 60s.
No, I did not. Now stop that.
But I wanted to talk to you about the exhibit, and what would we see with regard to Groovy Ads from the 60s?
Groovy Ads deals with the rock promotion posters that came out, started around 1965, and were pretty much over by 1969, centered in the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco, and their impact on the world of advertising. Now, that differs from a lot of art museum exhibits on the same topic. San Diego Museum of Art did a rather large show called High Societies, which looked at the posters as purely art. We looked at them as cultural manifestations of the counterculture, literally, how they affected graphic design, how they affected advertising in general. So I did a whole section at the beginning of the show of the origins of the beat culture, hippie culture, why San Francisco, and then talked about the artists who produced these things, people like Wes Wilson and Stanley Mouse, Mouse Studios and the other designers who produced them, talked about the history then, Summer of Love, and then got into the spread of psychedelia outside of San Francisco after 1967, after the Summer of Love period, into getting to people like Peter Max,
right,
Milton Glaser, Seymour Quast, and then the whole decline of the Haight culture. But then, in the early 70s, how this all became mainstream.
That's very interesting. Yeah, it did parallel with, it kind of had its own genre and own appeal back in the 60s, and then eventually did get into the mainstream. And, of course, when he says the Haight, of course, in today's world, that would be rap music, the Haight
exactly.
influence.
Yeah, right.
I wanted to ask you, we mentioned, and since we're on the radio, the Eisner Museum has a radio studio. Talk a little bit about your radio studio,
sure.
Chuck.
Sure. That's a fun component. It's one of the few permanent features in the museum. And what that is, it's a booth, basically, a little bit bigger than a phone booth. And it's a place where there's a touchscreen display, and kids mostly, but adults like to go in there every so often, get a choice of recording one of about a dozen different standard types of radio commercials, whether they be jingles, and you get historical jingles like the My Baloney Has the First Name, or Slinky, or Meow Mix.
Right.
So you can record those, and it guides you through it. You can practice, record it, and then play it back for yourself and your friends. Or you can paint a verbal picture of a jazz club in one of three different variations, not a jazz club, a restaurant in downtown Detroit called Porter's. And you can do a jazzy, you can do a rap, you can do a country version of that. There's also a sound effect. Finkel's Department Store.
You know, that's great. You're very informed, and I appreciate you joining us today, Chuck.
If you want to find out more about the William F. Eisner Museum, go to eisnermuseum.org. That's one way of doing it, like we do here on the Advertising Show on the web at theadvertisingshow.com. Stick around. Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth back in just a minute.
Simplifying the complex world of advertising. To reach Ray and Brad with your questions, log on to theadvertisingshow.com. This is The Advertising Show.
Oh, you need fluff, fluff, fluff to make a fluffer dutter. Marshmallow fluff and lots of peanut butter. First you spread, spread, spread your bread with peanut butter and marshmallow fluff.
It's the Advertising Show with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsythe back with you. And there again, there's an instructional spot, how to eat, how to make a fluffer nutter.
Oh, is that?
Sounds like something that Elvis would have eaten.
I thought it was a generic peanut butter spot.
No, I don't think so.
Fluffer nutter.
Fluffer nutter is I think it was in a can. It was a can of whipped garbage, and you spread it on your peanut butter. And
you're older than me, so I don't know.
I never ate it.
You look better with your teeth, by the way.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks.
Hey, you know,
just got him in the mail.
Having Chuck on the show, he mentioned during his radio studio that's there at the museum that you can play around with different spots. And he said, for example, My Baloney Has a First Name, and that coincides with a sign that's here in your studio. That
yes.
you use.
Yes.
It says My Baloney Has a First Name, and it says Ray Shillings. That's an interesting thing. But, Chuck is very informed, and he's fast becoming one of my favorite museum curators.
Mm-hmm.
of all the
kids. He has a uniform. He sits there and wears a little uniform and a cap and everything.
He does? Like,
at night he sweeps.
What does he do with the monkey?
With the monkey?
I just threw that out. I don't know.
Speaking of radio and radio ad spending, according to the Radio Advertising Bureau, and our good friend at the Radio Advertising Bureau,
Roger Dodson,
radio ad revenue for June up over 2% over the year-ago period, which is good news, up over 2% and up 3% for the first half. In June, local ad spending was flat. Well, the national ad spending was up 7% over last year. For the first half, local ad spending up 1%, national up 7%. So everything is up.
Wow.
So it's time to raise rates, folks.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's what they'll do. Hey, you know, you mentioned, or I mentioned.
You hear that Clear Channel?
Yeah, Infinity. Speaking of Infinity, Karmazin will be elected to the Radio Hall of Fame.
He will.
You didn't know this?
No.
You didn't get the email?
No.
No, I didn't either. I just
didn't get the invite.
Came across this. Gene Autry, who you know very well. He was who?
Sure.
He's an actor.
Well, sure. He's the cowboy, the singing cowboy.
Singing cowboy. A lot of people don't know this. This is a little trivia I happen to know. Mm-hmm. Gene Autry was the most highly decorated soldier for World War II.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either. I think my
father. Didn't he own a radio station, too, in L.A.?
Oh, the Autrys. Oh, sure,
yeah,
sure.
Time.
Anyway, I happen to know that as a little sidebar. Anyway, Gene Autry, Viacom executive Mel Karmazin are both going to be our nominees, rather, for the Radio Hall of Fame's class of 2003. Others to be inducted, Ray?
Yeah.
Well, Jim Bohannon out of Los Angeles, as well as, he's a national talk show host, I should say, out of Los Angeles talk show host Michael Jackson. No, not the gloved one.
Yeah.
Michael Jackson, if you've ever heard him. I believe it's KABC.
And I think so, yeah.
British guy.
Mm-hmm.
Great, great talk show host. And also the induction of Orion Samuelson of WGN. He is a
farm guy. Yeah,
yeah, farm broadcaster.
He's been around a long time, too.
People complain about having to follow him in the studio. Because he's a farm broadcaster. You know what it smells
stuff
like?
Stuff all
there?
Over his shoes.
Oh,
there.
Man, it's unbelievable. A lot of hay.
Yeah.
Straw.
Hey, speaking of that, it's time for our Goodvertising, Badvertising segment. And today we're lucky it's good.
Yeah.
It's all good.
And now it's time for the Advertising Show's Advertising Showcase. An outstanding example of on-target advertising for the good stuff. Here's Ray and Brad.
What do we got this week for good?
Well, you know, it's kind of a combo good advertising showcase here, and I decided from looking at the New York Times, I was going to, instead of take one ad, I'm going to take several ads, and I'm going to make a point here.
Okay, good.
As you can see, Ray, I pull open the New York Times, and after go to page two. It's usually where you go after the front page, you know.
Normally, yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at what's called fractional ads. They're typically somewhere between, say, 5 inches across and, say, 6, 7, 8 inches deep.
Mm-hmm.
We have a Chanel ad. We have a Torno ad. We have a Neiman Marcus ad. We have an Armani ad. We have a Lord & Taylor ad. We have a Saks Fifth Avenue ad. We have a Tiffany's ad. These are all on the same page. You know what they all have in common?
What?
They have one single item
mm-hmm.
that they're featuring within the ad.
Very easily readable. I'm probably about 20 feet away from you in another studio, and I can easily see what they're selling there.
Yeah, and, you know, we've received email over the past several weeks from local advertisers saying, you know, you're always featuring national advertisers, although my argument has always been you can learn from national advertisers,
sure you
both
can.
Good and bad.
Yep.
And this is, of course, a national edition of the New York Times, but there's a lesson here for the local advertiser.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an ad, and whether, you know, regardless of the space, but certainly if it is a 5-inch by 8-inch ad, even though it's expensive, and my goodness, is there a newspaper that's more expensive than the New York Times? Maybe USA Today, I don't know, but it's a very expensive publication. So here we have a single feature in each ad. If you have an ad, local advertisers, and you have small space that you can only afford, don't try to stuff everything in that ad because you're thinking, hey, this is costing me a lot of money.
Yeah.
I need to get my value. The value is in communicating.
Mm-hmm.
People read newspapers for editorial, not for your ad. So if you can keep it clean, white space is a good thing.
Yeah.
And keep your features down to only one. Here's 6, 7, 8 examples.
Yeah, it's great.
Of advertisers in the New York Times, one feature per ad. Try to stay with that, folks.
You can also apply that to your radio advertising as well or your television advertising. Keep a lot of white space there, too.
True.
Just because you have 60 seconds or 30 seconds doesn't mean you need to get everything in there.
Keep your message down to maybe accomplishing only one or two thoughts across to the viewer.
And floss daily.
That's true. And also try to use a bleach.
bleach on your teeth?
Wherever.
Okay. The Advertising Show brought to you by Advertising Age Magazine. You can visit online at adage.com. You can also visit us here at theadvertisingshow.com. That's where we stream the show live and also have the archive programs as well. The Advertising Show with Ray Shillins and Brad Forsyth is a Big Radio Midgets production. And we are here nationwide on the SSI Radio Network.
Welcome to The Advertising Show, America's only radio program focusing on advertising, media, marketing, product development, branding, new media, sales and customer relations. Stay with us for entertaining marketing discussion and our special guest interview. Now, here are your hosts, Ray Shillins and Brad Forsyth.
Advertising Show, it's another great hour to be with you and to learn a little bit more about advertising and marketing communications. We've got a special guest coming up this hour, and his name is Chuck Sable, curator of the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design. We're going to give you a radio tour of the museum. It's located in Milwaukee. If you want to find out more, though, you can go online at eisnermuseum.org. O-R-G.
Right.
Org.
Org.
Yeah. We got Patrick Meyer this half hour with Fusion 5 and the Marketing Insider. We also have, the Wacky World of Marketing, Bruce Abbott coming up before the bottom of the hour.
One of my favorites.
And Andy Gorowitz here on the Advertising Show, being brought to you by Advertising Age Magazine. Visit online at adage.com. Advertising Show, a Big Radio Midgets production on the SSI Radio Network. As I said before, we stream live in addition to the satellite stuff. We do it on the Internet as well.
And, you know, if you're listening and you have to get out of your car, and who does it? After a while, right?
What's a good thing?
Well, and by the way, pick up my dry cleaning and Ray's too. It's at that cheap store around the joint.
The Dollar Cleaners.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you are listening and you have to leave your car and you're thinking, wow, that was such an interesting interview, I wish I would have been able to stick around, go to theadvertisingshow.com and click onto our archive section, and you will be able to, in the comfort of your home or office, do it at your office. You may get fired, but who cares? You'll have more time to listen to the show.
Right.
You can listen at your leisure, theadvertisingshow.com, and again, click on the archive section. And any show that we've been airing for the past 3 or 4 months is sitting there waiting for your mouse.
Yeah, just push play or something like that.
Hey, Ray, you mentioned
Save As.
Yes, you mentioned Roger Dodson. I want to make a point here.
Mm-hmm.
Guess who is being inducted into the Hall of Fame of Broadcasting, Hall of
Rogers?
Fame for Nebraska, for the state of Nebraska.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah.
That's great.
I received an email on that from not him, because he's too, you know, he's too...
humble.
A humble pie. Great group, by the way.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Uh-huh.
And he's too humble, or as we say down here in the South...
Humble.
Yeah, where'd that H go? he's too humble to tell people this. I had to learn from a different person.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sent Roger an email saying, Roger, congratulations, yada, yada. I said, send me a press release. I'd like to mention it on the advertising show.
Sure.
Guess what?
What?
He didn't respond.
He didn't?
No. I'll just have to ad lib.
Maybe it was
this.
A surprise, Brad, and you screwed it up.
Well, maybe
that's not good.
Maybe they said, we're going to induct you if you can keep it a secret for the next few months.
Well, he loves Nebraska.
He does.
Lives in Kansas City, doesn't he? Yeah.
Well, he says that there's two reasons why he lives in Nebraska. It's Omaha, by the way.
Omaha?
Yeah.
Okay.
He says there's two reasons why. Because he wants to and he can.
Okay.
That's what he says.
Yeah. And apparently in Nebraska there are some good golf courses there, so he's a
really?
Big golfer as well. So.
Take a left at the corn. Stock.
Yeah.
Huskers.
There you go.
Yeah.
We've got Chuck Sable coming up here in just a little while on the Advertising Show. But right now it is Patrick Meyer from Fusion 5. Take a listen.
Welcome to Understanding the Future Now. It's the Marketing Insider featuring Patrick Meyer.
Here is something CMOs want to do immediately when they hear about it, and it's lacking in almost every marketing plan. It's called brand mythology. Imagine if you go on a date and learn everything about that person on the first date. Why would you ever want to see them again? The same is true with consumers. They want an evolving, often intriguing, delightful brand experience that continues to unfold. Create a continuously evolving story that can be told again and again by your loyal fans, by people in the know, by anyone considering your brand. Here's how you can get started. Number one, do your homework. What's the heritage of the brand? The history? Talk to your biggest fans, people loyal to your product. Talk to people building the brand for tomorrow, and you'll find a rich mosaic of nuggets on which to build your myth. Number two, actually create a story, a myth, that you want people to buzz about. Number three, identify who can seed your mythology. Your people, people that touch your brand, key influencers, and do it through publicity, public relations, or one-on-one contact. Number four, now add brand news value. All those nuggets that can surprise and delight consumers, bits that intrigue them, new products, new advertising, publicity, consumer stories, weave them all together into your myth so they unfold today and over the next 18 months. Want more information on brand mythology? Go to Fusion5.com and click on Turbochargers.
You've been listening to The Marketing Insider, heard every week here on The Advertising Show. Join us next week for more insight into the future of marketing.
This is Patrick Meyer, CEO of Fusion 5. Remember, the marketing revolution has begun.
Yes, it has, all over the country.
True, at least here.
There you go. Well, yeah. I'm glad. It's about time, isn't it?
It is about time. He is a very cutting-edge guy, and I'm just so pleased that he's a part of the show.
Me too.
Yeah.
Great guy. About to talk to Chuck Sable, curator of the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design. Looking at the brochure here, it's a really cool place, too.
Yeah, it really is.
Looks kind of neat. We'll tell you more about that in just a minute. But,
since you're being casual with Charles Sable and calling him Chuck.
He said to call him Chuck. Says right there,
should
Chuck.
We call it the Billy Eisner Museum?
Billy Eisner.
Do you think? Hey,
no, I think we ought to stick with the original.
Do you remember last week when we had Scott Donatan on? He was critical of the restaurant reality show.
Yes.
And I kind of agree with him. It's totally product placement in your face. Yeah. New York City health inspectors have cited Rocco's, which, of course, is the restaurant that's featured on NBC's The Restaurant reality series, for a variety of health codes, Ray.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, they cited
slime
them
in the icebox?
Well, here's what they have. On July 29th, Rocco's was cited for flies in the kitchen.
Flies in the kitchen.
Dirty rags on the floor on the food preparation counter.
Uh-huh.
A missing light bulb. Cover. Now, yes. I think that's a bit of a stretch. Missing tiles, that's a bit of a stretch. And the lack of a self-closing door on the employee's restroom, which I thought, I got a copy of their company handbook.
Mm-hmm.
They listed the fact that their self-closing door did not work as an employee benefit. So I don't know why they got caught with that. But anyway, the restaurant has been gaining in ratings, with the show earning a 3.6 among adults 18 to 49 last week. So we'll see this Sunday. I believe it's a Sunday broadcast. How well it does if it continues to climb.
Flies in the Kitchen is actually a special they have at the restaurant. So that's why they had Flies in the Kitchen.
You know, I do watch the Food Channel, as I know you do too. And
sure.
Some places throughout the world, having a nice fried grasshopper is a delicacy.
Oh, yeah.
So a fried fly, if you could get your hands on one quick enough.
Yeah, Fear Factor, anything goes.
Fear Factor, you eat those things.
Yeah.
And then you're able to stick around for the next segment.
They asked a lady if she wanted to eat one of the night crawlers. No, they wanted her to eat one of the Madagascar cockroaches.
Mm-hmm. Those are the big ones, right?
The big ones, the missing ones.
Right.
And she said, no, could I eat two earthworms instead?
I'll trade you two
earthworms.
That's funny.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Speaking of reality shows, Martha Stewart.
She's taking in the
that's it.
In the apron.
Yes, exactly. she's not. It's not been doing real good there.
No,
earnings are down. She's not looking. They have an AP photo here at AdAge.com of her.
Can I look
at it? Not the most flattering photo.
Well,
she's a little wear and tear there.
I'd say she's pissed.
Yeah.
And plus, they're moving her program around to where it's moving to the wee hours of the morning. For those that are committed, usually they commit to those programs for many, many quarters out. They think the local stations think they're so smart in saying, I'm going to secure this program for a year.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you get that kind of situation and you go, I said I would air it 2 a.m. You know, not to be confused with the Kobe Bryant hour. No, I'm
just what's going on with that?
Well, I don't know. I haven't heard. I guess they're doing court right now.
That's right. They're doing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like music.
Yeah, that'll wake you up.
Hello.
Yeah.
We've got to take a break on the advertising show, but when we come back, we've got Chuck Sable from the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design as part of the advertising show with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsythe. Stay right here.
Make your advertising dollars work smarter. You're listening to The Advertising Show with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsythe.
Sometimes you feel like a nut, sometimes you don't. Almond Joy's got nuts, Mounds don't. Almond Joy's got real milk chocolate, coconut and munchy nuts too. Mounds got deep dark chocolate and chewy coconut. Ooh. Sometimes you feel like a nut.
It's the Advertising Show with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth. And from Milwaukee today, Chuck Sable, who is the curator at the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design. Let me tell you a little bit about the museum and about Chuck here, too. William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design is dedicated to the memory of Eisner for his contribution and support to the advertising and design professions. It is a place where visitors of all ages can experience the power of advertising on our culture. How does advertising affect us? How do our attitudes and ideas influence its constantly shifting currents? And why do some ads become memorable while most ads are discarded, like yesterday's newspaper? The Eisner Museum attempts to answer these questions and many others through insightful, innovative, and interactive exhibits that probe the nature of the popular culture. I see in the brochure here we have the big boy character. Mm-hmm. Been around a long time.
At the restaurant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In the Cleveland area, it was Manners Big Boy. There was Frisch's Big Boy. What was it in the Houston area?
They had a big...
you have it in St. Louis?
I don't recall. We had our... It was called the Big Boy. I think it was just the Big Boy down there here in Houston. But in St. Louis, when I lived there, I don't recall a Big Boy. I recall many White Castles.
Oh.
But no Big Boys.
Oh, love White Castle.
I do recall some Big Boys, but they had nothing to do with restaurants.
Chuck Sable is a curator of the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising Design. And a part of the show today, we're talking to Chuck out of Milwaukee.
Yeah, Chuck, for those familiar with the Milwaukee area, how would they get to your, for those not familiar, I should say, with the Milwaukee area, where are you located there in Milwaukee?
We're in downtown Milwaukee. Uh-huh. In an area called the Historic Third Ward, which is just south of downtown. It's an area that's undergoing a major rehab, gentrification. It was light manufacturing originally, and now it's lots of condos and boutiques and condos and things like that.
Is it down there by the original Pabst Brewery?
That's a little bit north of us, actually.
Did you know, Ray, that two developers have teamed up to purchase the and renovate the sprawling historic but long vacant Pabst Brewery complex?
Really?
Yeah.
What do they want to do?
Right here in the New York Times earlier this week. Well, apparently they're going to revitalize it and then create some kind of a historic area down there for shopping and so forth.
That's a great idea. That's something that happened in the Houston area with the Imperial Sugar Company.
Mm-hmm.
In the Sugarland area, there is a vacant building that is historic and really cool. It's multi-story, about 7 or 8 stories.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just sitting vacant, basically. I would love to see them do something with that.
If you listen real closely, you can hear all of our listeners across America making reservations right now for the Pabst Brewery renovation or the Sugarland.
I would go there. I'd
the
love
Sugarland
that.
Deal.
Yeah.
You're a big fan of Pabst, aren't you?
I love
Ray?
Pabst. Yeah.
Right. You had one recently.
No, I haven't.
You said you had.
The last time I had one was in Minnesota.
Right.
Not Minnesota, Montana, Billings, Montana.
A couple months ago.
Yeah.
This has been Beer Talk here on the Advertising Show. So let's
long
jump.
Ashes to you.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the museum. For those, let's say we hit the door, we're walking in. What do we see as we enter the museum there, Chuck?
Well, the first exhibit you come in to see is called The Power of Advertising Corporate Identities, and it looks at various corporations, a selection of corporations, why or why they didn't keep the same corporate identities and how they've changed over the years, if they haven't.
Mm-hmm.
I compare and contrast about half a dozen major corporations.
So as we enter, so that's the first exhibit. What would we see next?
You come to the admissions desk.
Mm-hmm.
So after you've been wowed by that exhibit and said, ooh, this is a really cool place.
They're asking for some money.
And we're asking for some money.
Yeah, well, I can't blame you.
And then you come into the museum proper. And downstairs, the first thing you see is our lower gallery. All of which have changing exhibits. We don't have any permanent almost no permanent exhibits in the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, what's down there is the industrial designer, a retrospective show on the industrial designer who was the king of branding. His name was Brooks Stevens, and he was a Milwaukee native. He matured in the early 1930s and was most noted in the field of advertising and branding for producing the Miller,
mm-hmm.
speaking of beer, logo. What's known as the soft cross, as well as many other companies developing corporate identity systems for companies like 3M, Jeep over the years, local railroad called the Milwaukee Road.
Mm-hmm.
Developed their Hiawatha trains and the advertising and promotional materials that went with it.
Wow. So obviously he's a well-known designer up in your area.
Mm-hmm.
How do you locate somebody's work like that?
Archival sources locally.
Mm-hmm.
We actually produced the show with a major retrospective that's also running concurrently at the Milwaukee Art Museum on his industrial products, called Industrial Strength Design, Brooke Stevens. So it's really a part of a two-part show.
You know, I'm looking at a brochure right now on Brooke Stevens, and it does show the Miller beer, which he was involved in designing. And the,
is that a Studebaker there on there? Too?
Looks like it, yeah. So he had a hand in that, or he used to drive that Studebaker?
He had a hand in it.
Wow. Cool. You know, and I do recall reading somewhere, and I don't have that literature at my fingertips, but is it $4 to get in, as I recall?
Yeah. $4.50 is our general admission.
Yeah, very reasonable. Yeah,
ladies' night, 2-for-1, right?
Well, true.
Now, for college students, it's free.
Free for college kids.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
So that's a good reason to take a class again, Ray.
Yeah.
That if you wanted to join in.
CPR.
I know you mentioned that you have a radio studio. I want to talk a little bit about, and of course that's a little opportunity to get into a booth there, as Chuck mentioned, and do a little recording and kind of an experiential type of environment. Talk a little bit about your television studio that you have there. I guess it's not really a studio per se, but it's more of a gallery, I guess.
Right. That's permanent. It's one of the few permanent features of the museum, and it's outfitted by... was outfitted for us by a company called Midwest Express Airlines, or Midwest Airlines now is what they're called. And their hub is here in Milwaukee. They are the highest rated domestic airline for comfort. Every seat is first class. I know I'm giving them a commercial here.
Yeah, do you have your website there, Chuck?
Well, he has a lifetime pass on Midwest.
That's right. Anywhere they fly.
I have flown.
1-800-I-FLY-MIDWEST. Yeah, that's it.
Before you continue, I have flown Midwest Air. It's kind of a Midwest version of Southwest Air, isn't it? So the less expensive, more of the puddle jumper type deal.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by the first class seats.
First class leather seats, 2 o'clock. Yeah. And that's what we've got in our TV gallery.
And all the peanuts you can eat.
And so what would you see there in your gallery?
You see reels. What I'm running right now is, actually it's part of the Brooke Stevens show, interviews with him, and some commercials that he actually did back in the early 50s for the Hiawatha train here in Milwaukee, and then interviews with him about his life and his work. But usually it stands separate from an exhibit, and usually what I have in there are things like parts of the famous Cannes reel, Cannes International, Cannes Lions awards have played in there. I did a separate show recently on the early television commercials for cigarettes, and then later television commercials, the last television commercials that advertised cigarettes back in the early 70s.
So that's when those went away. That was early 70s, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. And they're quite interesting to look at today.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about that because I know you had an entire exhibit featuring, it was called Up in Smoke, Ray, a politically incorrect look at cigarette advertising. Of course, cigarette advertising has been historically examples of both good and, say, I don't know, misleading advertising. Mm-hmm. Take us through a retrospective, Chuck, if you will, of some of the early tobacco advertising.
Oh, my God, it's quite incredible.
Go ahead and fire up if you're listening out there.
The show actually was organized by the One Club for Art and Copy in New York. We took it as a traveling show and then significantly updated it and augmented it, since we have a bigger gallery space than what the One Club has in New York City. And we looked at the historical view. The show's divided into two parts. Historical views of cigarette company advertising, going back to about 1900 or so when the first advertising for cigarettes appeared, basically advertising what were called Turkish blends. Blends that were milder than, say, 19th century tobacco, that were basically roll your own. And then gradually, in the 1920s, how tobacco companies lured women to smoke through the suffragette movement, which is actually very interesting to see those ads in the 1920s, as well as celebrities. And we went into scenes then. Women advertising leisure ads, advertising cigarettes as leisure time activity, cigarettes promoting good health. Companies like the famous Camel ads for the T-Zone.
Sure.
That cigarettes will make 4 out of 5 doctors recommend Camels.
Man, times have changed, haven't they, Chuck? We've got to take a break. This is not a smoke break, though. Just a break, okay? Commercial break, because we like them commercials. On the Advertising Show, our special guest, Chuck Sable, curator of the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth. Back in just a minute. Stay right here.
And now, it's time for the Wacky World of Marketing.
Wacky World of Marketing.
Here's your host, Bruce Abbott.
Our wacky update heads to San Jose, California, where AP reports controversy over a cafe billing itself as the Hooters of coffee, complete with scantily clad waitresses, a foosball machine, and all that macho motif. The owner believes city officials are unfairly targeting his coffee shop, alleging the mobster-themed cafe is a den of prostitution. Since the cafe opened in February, city inspectors and police have ticketed the business for sponsoring lingerie shows. The desire of the neighborhood has always been for a Starbucks, says the Roosevelt Park Neighborhood Association. We feel they just snuck in. And that, my friends, is the wacky world of marketing.
This program was written and produced by Bruce Abbott, executive producer of The Advertising Show. Join us next time when we uncover the strange, the bizarre, and, unfortunately, the true wacky world of marketing.
To reach Ray and Brad with your questions, log on to theadvertisingshow.com. You're listening to The Advertising Show on the SSI Radio Network.
Do you know exactly how to read an Oreo? Well, to do it, you unscrew it very fast. Cause a kid will eat the middle of an Oreo first and say the chocolate cookie outside's for last.
See, there's so much frosty cream between.
It's The Advertising Show with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth. There's another instructional ad, how to eat a cookie, basically. Right. What a great idea. Yeah. And a memorable jingle, too. Special guest today on The Advertising Show is Chuck Sable, who's curator of the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising Design. Chuck is in Milwaukee today, where we're talking to him from, and that's where the museum is located as well. Also online, you can find out more by going to eisnermuseum.org.
Before the break, Chuck, we were talking about Up in Smoke, a exhibit you have there at the museum, a politically incorrect look at cigarette advertising through the 20th century. And when you mentioned Turkish Blend and rolling your own, it reminded Ray of going to college.
Stop that.
No, actually reminded me of going to college.
Yes.
But anyway, you were talking about doctors. I have been in, antique stores, and I've looked through magazines that they have there from the 40s and 50s, and I found it just laughable that many ads said, 4 out of 5 doctors recommend Chesterfield or whatever. And that's kind of where we left off in you describing your exhibit on tobacco. Talk a little bit more about that, if you would, Chuck.
Well, that was one section of the show that talked about various ads promoting health and how cigarettes can be healthy. athletes, it doesn't get your wind, is what athletes say. The other section, as I said, was celebrities. Opera stars smoke whatever brand. I can't remember the brand it was. Ronald Reagan promoting Chesterfields was a great section of the show. One of my favorite sections of the show were the actual companies themselves, the story of Marlboro, and how Marlboro cigarettes, owned, of course, by Philip Morris, were introduced to Americans in the 40s as a cigarette aimed at women.
Hmm.
Philip Morris was a British tobacco company trying to develop market share in America, and they weren't doing it for this cigarette, which had a filter. Which is what Marlboro had, and they changed agencies in the mid 50s. I believe they went to Leo Burnett, and Leo Burnett repositioned the brand as a macho cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
They started using male sort of archetypes. They went to a sailor first. They went to an auto mechanic, and finally, of course, you know who they ended up with, the cowboy.
Right.
And they tied into the mythology of the American individualist. American rugged individualist, the West, et cetera, and the rest basically is history.
And then, of course, and by the way, I believe that was the 50s when Leo Burnett took over and moved into that macho image, but it does seem like the 60s because that was when a lot of that innovative advertising was going on. But I have a cheat sheet in front of me because you sent it to me, Chuck. but what was interesting is we transitioned from tobacco industry. There's also an area that you use called the anti-smoking movement, and I will never forget. I remember seeing this, and as I look at this, it reminded me. Mm-hmm. You've got a billboard there, and it has a picture of a couple cowboys, and they're on horseback.
Yeah.
And the headline is "Bob, I've got emphysema,"
mm-hmm.
and you know it's a well deserved statement that maybe has some shock value there that plays off of advertising that people became very familiar with. I also see a little piece here that says 30-day mild test that proves what I've known about Camels for years. They are mild and taste great. And then it's signed Cole Porter. So, I mean, that was the days of some very prestigious individuals getting behind smoking. Very interesting exhibit, I must say. Is that still there at the, or is it concluded?
It just concluded July 28th. We closed it.
So what is the, you mentioned that you had the designer currently that you're featuring, Brooke Stevens.
Yeah.
Yes. Are there other exhibits that you've that you have there currently that we haven't touched upon?
Yeah, actually, there are two other shows that we do four or five shows at any one time here in the museum. A semi-permanent show that we have here is called Profiles, Seeing Clear, Who We Are, What We Buy, and How They Know. And it looks at psychographic profiling. What is psychographic profiling, and what kinds of systems are out there for market researchers? And we focus on a particular profiling system in this show called Values and Lifestyles, owned by a company called SRI in Palo Alto, California. And we chose it because it used the least number of individual psychographic profiling. And what that means is taking a country as diverse as the United States and breaking us down into belief systems. And that's what this particular profiling system does. It looks at belief systems and how we act then upon those belief systems in terms of purchasing decisions.
Wow. Well, that's kind of a marketing angle to everything. There's a consumer angle. You mentioned there were a few others. What else do you have there currently, Chuck?
We're opening a show on August 22nd called 100 Years of Harley-Davidson Advertising.
Yeah.
At the end of this month, at the end of August, is Harley-Davidson's 100th anniversary. And, of course, they're located here in Milwaukee. There's going to be a huge anniversary celebration last week in August.
You know, I think a lot of people don't think of Harley-Davidson advertising when they think of the bike. They think more of the mystique of the product itself, I believe, and, of course, the movie Easy Rider and so forth. Just in the last less than a minute we have, I want to get your thoughts on, have you ever considered doing anything or featuring an exhibit on the post-advertising since 9/11?
We have talked about it. A little bit. I know that the American Advertising Museum has done something on it. I personally think things haven't changed that much in advertising. Since 9/11, there was a flurry right after it, but lately things have calmed down, basically gone back to normal.
Well, that's interesting. Well, I got to tell you, if you're anywhere near the Milwaukee area or planning a trip to the Milwaukee area, I would encourage everyone, and I know I'm planning to do that one day soon, Ray, and I'll take you along as well because you know how much luggage I like to take. Anyway, the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design, great place, a lot of literature, eisnermuseum.org. And, Chuck, thanks so much for joining us.
We'll be back. We've got more conversation with Chuck. We're not letting him go yet, though, okay?
Oh, well,
there's more.
My goodness. It's
but
a
wait,
bonus round.
On the Advertising Show, stick around. We'll talk more about some of the artifacts and some of the cool stuff going on there.
Trying to get rid of Chuck.
No, don't go anywhere, Chuck. And don't you go anywhere either.
You're listening to The Advertising Show with Ray Schillins and Brad Forsythe.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honeybees and snow white turtle doves. I'd like to teach the world to sing with me.
It's The Advertising Show with Ray Schillins and Brad Forsythe, and our special guest today, Chuck Sable, curator of the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design. There's a product that has gone through a bunch of different songs and images and everything like that, Coca-Cola. That was a great early 1970s cut, don't you? Is that about about right to you?
I think it sounds right to me.
All right.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
Okay.
And I'll take soft drinks for 50, Alex.
Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hey, you know, Chuck, before the break, you were talking about Harley-Davidson, and I want to mention, because I'd like to talk a little bit about that. I know Harley is a product up in your area, right, Wisconsin?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And I, frankly, cannot recall any cutting-edge advertising yet associated with Harley-Davidson, but yet you're doing an exhibit on Harley. When I think of Harley-Davidson, I really think of, as I mentioned before, Easy Rider and the movie and the coolness.
Early product placement, folks.
Exactly. And they probably didn't pay for any of that.
They didn't pay for a dime for any of that.
Part of the story. And, of course, today, I believe, a lot of business executives and others ride Harleys because they feel like, you know, stepping out of their
status symbol.
Yeah. And so help us a little bit with understanding Harley-Davidson's advertising and what role it's played in their success.
Harley-Davidson advertising underscores the mystique. In fact, a little while ago, I was listening to a segment on the show on branding, and the idea of developing mystique, the mythology of Harley-Davidson, it ties into that so well. The story of Harley-Davidson, really the modern story, goes back to the early 80s when they became number one independent. They were owned by another company for about 10, 15 years or so. And in 1981, they were purchased by their managers, and they used this as a mythology to create the brand that we know today.
Hmm.
In terms of the idea of fighting competition, in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, both European and Japanese competition nearly forced Harley into bankruptcy.
Right.
Bankruptcy, and Harley successfully developed the image and the brand identity that secured their role today that you just described,
mm-hmm.
as this great macho sort of American rugged individualist image. And their advertising since the 80s, the brand identity, the logos, everything about them bespeaks this and underscores this. Their agency is a company called Carmichael Lynch up in Minneapolis.
Sure.
And they all their ads underscore this idea of Harley as someone who is rugged and individual, very much like the Marlboro Man in cigarette advertising.
I think it's interesting because the Marlboro Man was part of the brand and driving the brand. Harley-Davidson, I think, is a very good example, as you describe it, of a company that found its core value to its customer and figured out a way to advertise it and pulled itself out of some tough times. So you illustrate that very well. Since we're talking a little bit about product placement, I know you had an exhibit entitled Brought to You By, which is really, I guess, a focus on the golden age of radio. And anyone familiar with the early days of radio realizes that a lot of what we're seeing today actually started in the early days of radio. For example, product placement had its origins in the vintage radio programs. Talk a little bit about that, if you would,
Chuck. Oh, yeah. I mean, that was a fun show for us to do. What we did was you walked into the gallery and there was a timeline of history from the 1920s into the 50s, which was the golden age of radio. The actual sets that were produced were on the wall, actually in cases on the wall, so you could go through and look at the history of the radios themselves, photo panels of historical events, as well as news broadcasts from the time period, from Lindbergh landing in Paris in 1927 up through the famous Checker speech, which I fudged a little bit, which is Richard Nixon, of course, in 52, in the presidential campaign. So it takes you all the way through the history. And then there were listening stations, and you could listen to commercials by type, kids commercials, cigarette commercials, network promos and station identifications, as well as product placement. And that was one of the greatest uses of product placement of all, and that was Jack Benny, who did integrated ads in his show. And, of course, you know what his product was?
Texaco.
It was, of course, Lucky Strike Cigarettes.
Oh, Lucky Strike. I was thinking Texaco as well, too.
Texaco would have been Bob Hope.
Yeah.
No. No, Jack Benny did the Texaco stuff as well.
Well, he should have been a spokesperson for a violin maker. Well, you know, we just have a minute left. Ray wanted me to ask you if there are any X-rated risque advertising examples in your warehouse.
In our warehouse?
Well, or they're in your museum.
Don't think so.
Nope.
Good.
Other than you, Chuck.
Other than me,
no,
that's
X-rated.
It.
He's just rated R.
Yeah.
He's mild, you know, PG-13.
You know, I can't, I'll do this again since I did it last break. I'd like to encourage anyone that's in the area to go to the William E. F. Eisner, not E, but F. Eisner Museum, or visit.
The William E. Eisner Museum is next door.
Yes, that's
right.
Yeah. Or visit EisnerMuseum.org.
There you go. Thanks for being with us, Chuck, on the Advertising Show. It's Ray Shillings, Brad Forsyth, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Make informed decisions about your company's advertising strategy. This is the Advertising Show.
Back for our final segment this hour on the Advertising Show. It's Ray Shillings along with Brad Forsyth and a classic Pepsi generation spot.
Pre-Michael Jackson.
Cool music, too.
pre-Britney Spears.
Yeah, pre-everything, actually.
Pre-Flintstones.
I think it was Joni Summers.
Was it?
Yeah, I think it was Joni Summers.
You know, her voice sounds so recognizable, but yet I can't put the two and two together.
No, that's who I think it is.
Joni
Summers.
Summers.
She had a hit.
Not to be confused with Joni Mitchell.
No, who also had a hit or two.
True. You know, she's coming back. Joni Mitchell. I saw her on television about a year ago.
You did?
Gray hair.
Really?
She needs to be on Clairol commercials. Some women just need to go diet.
She did this song, The Big Yellow Taxi, which has now been redone by about three or four artists. That was her hit.
Really?
A long time ago.
I do remember that.
Anyway, it's the Advertising Show with Ray Shillings along with Brad Forsyth. You know, we don't take telephone calls here on the show, basically because we have no phone lines coming into the studio.
True.
Sadly, you know.
So if you try to call us and you get a busy, keep trying.
Keep trying. Yeah. No, don't do that.
No.
We do have the website, though. It's a great place to go for information, and you can send your questions to us. You can also find information about past guests, including the archive shows. That's the Advertising Show. .com. You know, McDonald's is doing something interesting. They're trying to change their...
Serving warm burgers?
Yeah, well, that's a novel item, isn't it?
What?
No, what they're doing is they're... I believe if you're McDonald's, you need to be McDonald's and not try to be a Starbucks or something else, right?
True.
Okay. So they can access the Internet. This is in New York at several locations, free with the purchase of a value meal. Come on. In Raleigh... They can order the value meal at a kiosk and have it delivered to their table. Now, I've seen those kiosks before. They had a test market kiosk just north of Houston at one of them.
So what, it's like in the regular area instead of standing in line? Is that what they're saying?
Yeah, you walk in. It's a little kiosk, and mm-hmm. you punch in your order. And then when you walk over to the – and you charge, you know, with a charge card and everything, mm-hmm. and you walk over and pick up your meal.
Hmm.
So that's kind of cool, but let's see, what is this? Rockford, Illinois. McDonald's customers are being seated after being seated by a host.
Yeah, I've heard about
Come
that.
Come on. They can eat their value meal. Notice the value meal keeps coming up.
Right.
With the clear flat wear off black plastic china.
Hmm.
So come on.
You know, you mentioned the card for the wireless for the laptop. Of course, Starbucks was one of the big innovators with that, but they're smarter. They didn't say you have to buy a product to be able to do it. They just sold the cards that you can only use in the Starbucks that it encourages you to be there. And when you're there, invariably you're going to have a coffee or whatever.
Sure. I just don't believe that McDonald's needs to do stuff like that. They need to be who they are.
Well, I tell you what they need to do. They need to get their act together and deliver the product that made them successful to begin with, which is what I think they're missing right now.
Like the White Castle we talked about earlier. White Castle never tried any of that crap.
Still a White Castle.
You got it. Here's Andy Borowitz on the Advertising Show.
Hi, this is Andy Borowitz for the Advertising Show. And now here's this week's feature from the Borowitz Report.
Seabiscuit, the star of the hit Universal Pictures release bearing his name, has entered the hotly contested California gubernatorial race, election officials confirmed. The celebrated horse, who is running as a Democrat, is likely to pose the strongest challenge to the newly announced candidacy of actor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who declared his intentions one day earlier. At Schwarzenegger for Governor headquarters, jittery campaign aides indicated that they were blindsided by the critically acclaimed mammal's decision to run. At this time, we thought we'd be facing off against Arianna Huffington or maybe Dianne Feinstein, one Schwarzenegger aide said. If we'd known that Seabiscuit would be running, we might never have gotten into this thing. According to the latest polls, Seabiscuit would trounce Schwarzenegger by a 64% to 32% margin, with the remaining 4% favoring a write-in candidacy for Nemo, the star of this summer's Finding Nemo blockbuster. Seabiscuit started his campaign on the offensive, challenging Mr. Schwarzenegger to a series of televised debates on the issues of crime, the environment, and the economy. At Schwarzenegger headquarters, campaign aides said it was highly unlikely that Mr. Schwarzenegger would accept Seabiscuit's debate challenge, since the film actor was likely to suffer in comparison to the world-renowned horse. Seabiscuit neighs and whinnies a lot, but he's still a lot easier to understand than Arnold, one aide admitted.
This is Andy Borowitz, and this has been a special edition of the Borowitz Report from the Advertising Show. To read more reports or to receive daily email alerts, log on to borowitzreport.com. This is Andy Borowitz saying, keep it fake, baby.
There you go. So Seabiscuit's in the race, too.
I love that.
A nose ahead.
That's funny. That's funny. I like the part about you can understand him better than Arnold.
Talk about fat food and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Krispy Kreme.
Oh.
Nobody ever sued Krispy Kreme.
For getting fat after
For getting
that.
Fat because...
Right. You knew what you were getting. Well, you know what you're getting at all those places.
It's true.
Yeah.
They're going to be in the UK, by the way.
They have done very well. They're a public company. I would put my money on a Krispy Kreme.
Yeah.
Stock.
Buck.
That's your stock tip for the day. Do we need a disclaimer?
No.
These are not recommendations for investments.
Investment
or securities.
Is
yeah,
whatever they say.
Yeah.
Hey, next week we've got Michael Shell, who's author of Buyer-Proof Selling, Sales Strategies from the Buyer's Side of the Desk. That ought to be interesting, too.
It is an interesting concept.
And we want to thank Charles Sable, Chuck, as we've come to know him, curator of the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design in Milwaukee.
Billy Eisner.
So we'll see you next week on The Advertising Show. Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth. Advertising Show has been brought to you by Advertising Age Magazine. You can visit online at adage.com. Stay in touch throughout the week at theadvertisingshow.com. Drop us a note. The Advertising Show is a Big Radio Midgets production, and we are nationwide on the SSI Radio Network.